Okay, my name's John, and I am a dope addict. And I came into the program February 2nd, 19. And, you know, I used and drank just like everyone else, and the last day of my using, you know, I did just a little line. And it didn't dawn on me until I'd been to a lot of meetings and whatnot, but it quit working. One of my friends came by, he'd went down south and got some dope and came back and asked me if I wanted to do a little bit. And, you know, I've been laying in bed trying to quit on my own like many times before. And when he came by, you know, I said, yeah, I'll do a little bit. So I did a little line. And when he left, I went back to bed. Little did I know that my family had been talking to these people at this outpatient program and set up an intervention for me. February 2nd, they came out to do this intervention, and I was laying in bed with my dog, which was my best friend, and still is. And I heard these voices in the front room, and didn't pay much attention to it. My sister came out and said, you know, will you come in and talk to these men for a minute? And I said, yeah, I guess, you know. And I went in, and they asked me to sit down, and I wouldn't sit down. Because my choice of drug was speed, and I like to dance around a little bit. These guys, you know, they started talking all this weird stuff to me about that it didn't have to be like that anymore. And this one guy was talking real nice to me, you know, and I thought, well, this son of a bitch is gay. And this other guy was kind of a little more, I wasn't talking nice, but, you know, it was gentle, I guess. And it came down to, you know, I called them every name in the book, and this one guy I was able to run off, the guy that I thought was gay. I was able to run him off, I thought. The other guy got right up in my face, you know, about an inch from my face, and I was calling him every name in the book, and I just couldn't get rid of him. No matter what I said to him, you know, he just stayed there, and he said, it don't have to be like this anymore. You know, it ran through my head, what's the matter with this guy? But the guy that I thought ran off, he had went and got a warrant, signed a better deal of restraining order, and brought the cops back with him. And they told me to get out of the house. And at that time, I wasn't working, and was coming down, and, you know, I thought, well, man, these people don't understand, these people don't care, they don't love me, you know, how dare them run me out of my mother's house. You know, I'm 42 years old, still living with my mom. But, you know, the cops came out, told me I'd have to leave. Well, I jumped up, got on my motorcycle and took off, and went over to a friend's house, and he's a diabetic and had a reaction the day before, and went to the hospital, and so, you know, I thought, well, I can't sleep in the house, so I have to go home and get my sleeping bag. So I went back home, got my sleeping bag. My people called the police on me again. Police came, and I was able to get out of the house, you know, before they got there. Then I went back over to my friend's house and crawled underneath the bush, and was going to stay there forever, you know, and lived there about, I don't know, an hour. And the longer I laid there, the madder I got. So I went back home. The doors were locked, and I had to break in, you know, and everybody in the house was yelling, he's back, he's back, you know. And I'm thinking, well, what's the matter with these people, you know? Should I live here, man? And they're screaming that I'm back, and I said, you son of a bitch, can't run me out of my house. Never my house to begin with, but you can't run me out of my house. So I go back in the bedroom, and I'm laying there talking to my dog, and I hear these little walkie-talkies, you know, and the police came back. And they told me I was going to have to go to jail. So, you know, I said, okay, I'll go to jail. And, you know, I was calling my family all kinds of names. And, you know, how dare them do this to me. And they took me down to the jail and booked me on breaking a restraining order. Put me up on the fourth floor where the women used to be. They built a new jail and moved all the women out. Put me up on the fourth floor, and I was in there a couple of days, and it came time for me to go to court. So, you know, my thinking was, well, I'll plead guilty to this, I'll be able to go out to road camp, and maybe get 90 days or whatever. So it worked out when I went to court, went up in front of the judge. He read off a charge, possession of cocaine and assault and battery. And I was guilty. And he goes, get out of here, you know? And I'm thinking, man, what's up here? But, you know, he wouldn't let me go back to jail. And they took me back. And you know, they dressed me out before noon, before I even got lunch, you know? And they kicked me out. And I'm thinking, you know, I can't even go to jail right. You know, what's happening here? And I didn't have enough money to make a phone call or nothing. And I walked back over to a friend's house, and he still wasn't out of the hospital yet, so I walked over to another friend's house and asked him if I could use the phone to call my sister. So I called her, and she came over, and, you know, with full intentions in my head that I was going to con her into letting me go back home and do it again on my own. Try again on my own. But when she showed up, she had this little security guard behind her and an old Ford Courier pickup. And, I mean, his hat hung down over his ears, and he had a big walkie-talkie on his side, and his pants were too big for him, and his shirt was dirty. And you know, I just thought, well, what's this guy doing here? You know, she wouldn't go anywhere unless this guy followed us. And, you know, she told me that, if I got violent or anything, that, you know, he would call the cops. So she took me down to this outpatient program, and from there I went into a recovery home. Well, the guy who took me out to the recovery home, you know, we walked in the doors of it, and here's this little guy, probably 70 years old, and ran the place, and he asked me if I wanted anything to eat. And I did, but I didn't want to tell him, you know, that I wanted something to eat. And we sat down at the dining room table, and we talked a little bit. And you know, I had nowhere to go, so I thought, well, I guess I got to stay here. I was out there for a few days, and I think it was 14 days. It was a 28-day program, and I was out there for 14 days. And left, and went immediately into an outpatient program, 58-week outpatient program. And, you know, I really don't know if I ever had the intention to stop using drugs or not. But it's worked out, you know, that I haven't had to since that day. And you know, they told me to get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor, and, you know, this man, he's a big guy, tattoos from his elbows down on both arms, and rides a motorcycle. And you know, I thought he would be kind of easy on me. But it turned out, you know, it's this guy, he insisted that I work the steps. He insisted that I call him every day. And I did. And you know, it got to, I would call him, and he could tell by the tone of my voice if something was wrong or not. And, you know, he invited me on some trips. At 4 months clean and sober, I got to go back to Akron, Ohio to another convention. And, you know, like, here's all these thousands of people walking around with their hands out. You know, I didn't know if they were blind and forgot their canes or what was going on, you know. But everybody back there was real friendly, and they accepted what I was, I guess. You know, everybody walked around and said welcome and everything. And I got to meet a lot of other people there. You know, they also told me to get rid of my old friend. And, you know, that was kind of hard for me to understand. But I was able to do that. One way that I was able to do that is, one of my friends called me one day from Fresno, asked me if I knew where any drugs were. And I told him, no, I don't. I don't do that stuff anymore. And he says, well, don't you have a phone number or something that you can give me? So the only thing that was off the top of my head, I gave him the NA information line. I said, well, maybe you can score there. And I haven't heard from him since. Another one of my friends, I was driving down the road one day and I saw him sitting out on his front porch and he was drinking a beer and I stopped and asked him if he wanted to go score with me. Man, he jumps up out of the chair, he runs in the house, puts his shirt on and comes back out and goes, let's go. Jumps in the car, he's all smacked back and drinking his beer and off we head to Farmersville. And we're going down all these little country roads and he's going, turn here, there's a guy down there we can score from. And I'm telling him, hey, I know a place that we can score and good stuff. And he goes, well, how do you do it? Any way you want. So we pull up to this meeting and, he says, what's this? There's all these people walking in, I said, well, throw your beer in the trash can there and come on in. And we walked in, this guy's reeking of alcohol and pot, and his eyes are all glossy. And he sat through the meeting with me, and I ain't seen him since either. So I guess God was doing for me what I couldn't do for myself, it hasn't been all roses and peaches, but, it's been better. I hear people say that when they were using drugs that they never got off the block. And that was me. I had neighbors and I didn't know them. We were about 2 months ago, a group of us were invited to go down to Marina Del Rey and go out on a yacht with a man. I'd never dreamed of doing something like this, And here we are in this real classy place, and we went out on a yacht for the day. And things like that are happening for me today, there's times, that I think about using, and then it pops in my head that I know another recovering addict and he's got the same disease as I've got. Maybe I'll call him and find out how he's doing it today. That's worked for me. The times that I've wanted to use, I've called somebody and talked to them or went over to their house and just sat. I had a friend that came in the same time I did. And he chose to go back out. And he didn't die in vain because the end of this month, end of July, I was able to go over to the cemetery and put a year chip on his gravestone. He would have had a year. He's clean and sober and serene, I guess. But, he chose to go back out and he showed me that, it doesn't get any better out there. And I'm grateful for that, that I could see that. They talk about spiritual awakenings, and I haven't had any big burning bush or anything, but I've had a lot of them. I've had a lot of little ones, and the ones that I call my big ones are when I'm able to recognize the little ones. I'm grateful for that today, and with that, I'll shut up.
Thank you. All right. There is a coach machine. I'm sorry. I'm ready for the main speaker, Dave from Vicarious.
I'm 90 Day Dave, and I'm a drug addict.
Dave.
This thing on? I'd like to welcome all the people from Bakersfield and I'd like to welcome all the people who didn't get chips. I'd like to welcome all the people still chipping. Contrary to popular belief, it does happen. I was one of the great ones to do it. Thought I was pulling off a real neat one. This isn't anything like I had envisioned in my head what it would be like. You know, like, where's the podium and where's the 900 people and, you know. I'm glad it's like this. It feels more informal. And I got into recovery thanks to Johnny Carson and Ed McMahon.
Oh,
not very many people can say that. I was working at the NBC affiliate in Fresno. I was the guy that pressed the buttons and made the commercials come on and go off and put the shows on and everything. And that day I hadn't been able to score, and I chickened right there on the job, and I'm like, I don't know about you guys, I hear the other people's stories, and I was kind of a weird junkie when I kicked. I went to sleep. You know, all these other guys that when I got into halfway homes and all that rigmarole, all these guys that are kicking, you know, they're staying awake and they're flopping and everything else. About the first 10 hours or whatever that I went out. I'd go out like a light. You know, it's like all I was running on was dope. And that's what was keeping me moving. And so I was working the graveyard shift and watching the Tonight Show and doing everything I could to stay awake. And next thing I know is I come to and I got my head down on the console and I kind of looked around before I lifted my head up and went, oh, fuck, you know. And I set up, then I, you know, like real quick, and I look at the monitor and, you know, Johnny Carson's still on. I'm like, oh, fuck, all right. I wonder how long I've been out. Man, I hope I haven't missed any commercials, you know. And about that time, Johnny goes, well, good night, Ed. And I go, oh, fuck. And I look down on this log, and luckily I'd only missed one commercial break. I wasn't that lucky. During the Johnny Carson show, they ran anywhere from $800 to $1,500 for a 30-second spot. And by me writing down whether or not they ran is how the station got their money. So I put it down and ran. You know, the fuck? Nobody's watching, man. It's almost 1 o'clock in the morning, you know. Only a dope addict's probably watching this, and so, you know, they won't snitch. And I had to stay there all night. We went off the air at like 2 o'clock in the morning, and we came back on at 6 in the morning, and I'm running all these cartoons. And I mean, it was like a, you know, God was putting his foot down that night, and I just didn't realize it. Because the whole night was like what's called a clusterfuck. Had a new guy in there that didn't know diddly squat about what he was doing, and you know, and I didn't want to mess with him, you know. I wanted to sit in that little booth and shut the door, and you take care of everything out there like you're supposed to. And we're getting ready to run Bugs Bunny like at 6 o'clock in the morning, and he's got this film up on the projector, and how this guy thought this film was going to go this way and that way, I have no idea. He had this thing running like a road map of L.A., you know, and we're like 30 seconds till we're on the air, and I strip this thing down, and we end up getting on late, and so I'm having to pull little things out, you know, that right before you come back to the cartoons, it said, now back to Bugs Bunny, and I'm having to pull those things out to catch up on time. And later on that night, he had recorded David Letterman, and somehow he pushed the wrong button, and he recorded on two different tapes, you know, half here and half there, and halfway through the second recording, he records him rewinding the first tape. And that got on the air. And then they had this other little stupid cartoon that come on from the network. It's 7 o'clock, you know, and I get off work at 7:30. All I got to do is one more 2-minute break, and I'm off work. Next thing I know, some guy's tapping me on the shoulder going, hey, are you going to go home or what? And it's like 7:45. So and I jump up real quick, some little snorkely animals or something. And I write down again and I ran the commercials. And here was the whole next shift standing over the top of me watching me do this, you know. They came down on me. They came down on me pretty hard. And for a long time I had a resentment against the dude that I worked with on there, you know, because everything that happened that night, he put on me. I mean, he did, you know, and it was my fault. I didn't write down that there was mistakes that had happened and everything. So, hell, he's going down for this beat. Let's give it all to him, you know. That day, when I came back a couple of days later, and that's when I got busted for it. And that day I was supposed to start methadone maintenance. I had the letter from the doctor. I'd gone through my two detoxes. I had a history of over 2 years of heroin addiction. My ex-wife came to pick me up outside of work to take me over to the methadone clinic to do it. And I walked out and I got in the car and I said, you know what them fuckers did? They fired me. Can you believe this, you know? And I started running this story out to her, and she goes, let's just get over to the clinic and let's get this done. And it was like the strongest response I had ever heard from her in the 5 years that we were together. Fuck you, I ain't carrying your ass anymore. Oh, man. And the only thing I was thinking of is, where am I going to get the $70 a month to stay on this maintenance? You know, if she says no, God, you know, that'll have to come out of my pocket. And the only thing I'm thinking of, you know, getting on maintenance, I'm not thinking about just get on maintenance, so I don't have to go off the score anymore. I want to get on maintenance so I don't have to buy as much anymore, you know. She told me, she says, you know, you made me a promise that the next time you fucked up, you were gonna get help. And I said, well, maybe we need to talk this over. You know, she didn't want to have nothing to do with it, you know, no way, you're not getting by on this one. And I thought, well, I was getting ragged, man, and I was getting tired, and I was getting real sick of all the shit I was pulling, and you know, the feeling and everything. It gets real funky. It does something real bad to your self-esteem, too, when you walk into a room of family members and all the women running to hide their purse. You know, everybody kept their purse wrapped around them. Some of them, you could watch them out front, put them in the trunk before they came in the house. I'd already had to move back in with my folks. There was 9 of us living in the house. 6 adults and 3 children, and all 6 adults were practicing alcoholics or drug addicts. And you want to talk about some insanity that was going on, man, and it was everybody else's fault in that house but the person who was doing it. You know, and it really seemed like they were picking on Dave, too, man, you know. My mom, man, would come in drunk and go, you're fucking this family up. You know? And everybody's down on me, you know, Dave, you're getting loaded, you're fucking everything up. And I'm going, look at him, he's fucking drinking, he's, you know, fall down drunk and everything's, yeah, but he's paying the bills. And I went, oh, well, I can see your point of view there. I don't think it's very fair, but I can see your point of view. You know, the fair part, I've come to the conclusion that there's this little dope addict fairy that runs around to all of us when we're kids, and knows we're all going to become dope fiends, and it hangs out by your ear, and it goes, life is fair, no matter what. Anybody tells you life is fair, right? And then you grow up, and you go, oh, it's not fucking fair, you know? Somewhere, somehow, that happened to me. And, you know, I thought life was supposed to be fair. And what fair, you know, meant to me was it goes my way. That's it, all the way. Anyway, they called around and they tried to get me in places, you know. I had to go inpatient, man. I had to be locked in somewhere. I couldn't, you know, no outpatient thing for me. I'd already tried hypnosis. That was a fucking joke. I stayed clean for 3 days. You know? I stayed clean for 3 days, and all of a sudden it dawned on me, I think I'll go see if I'm really hypnotized. I went to the connection and I swore and I said, if I'm really hypnotized, I ain't gonna fit. Stepped it up, fucking shot it up, and that fucking hypnotism don't work, you know? And tried to explain that to the old lady too. I tried an experiment today. That's exactly what I told her. I experimented. I had to see if I was really hypnotized. It didn't feel like it when I was in that room. And then I got really self-righteous too because she got pissed off because it cost her $75. You know? I was like, hey, you know, we're talking about my life and you're worried about $75. You know, and an hour later I'm thinking, fuck, I could use that $75 to... You know, if I had got that from her and said I was going to go get hypnotized. You know? They called everywhere. They called everywhere and tried to get me in. I had no insurance that would cover anything. The only place in Tulare County that is any kind of inpatient is alcohol only. And at the point where I was at, you know, I'm a junkie, fuck you, I ain't no alcoholic. You know, I got clean for a while and it dawned on me that I'd stayed off of heroin for 4 years drinking like a fish. You know, and I remember I used to brag to like all my family members or people that I was partying with, you know, I've been clean for 4 years. Drunker than shit and smoking coke, you know. And I thought I was, man. I'm off the heroin. Heroin causes me problems, you know. I even joined the Navy to get off the heroin. And you know, something happened to me. We got to go over to Israel. We went over to Israel and we took a cab up to Nazareth to score hash. I was scared, and one of the people we had to go through was a priest. And I'm like, you know, this isn't right. There's some, you know, we're here at the birthplace of Christ. You know, and we're scoring dope. For some reason, this don't seem right, you know. And we did it. Some of the best hats I ever had. It's crazy. We got back on the ship, you know. We get back on the ship, we can't find any place to smoke it, you know. You get on these bigger aircraft carriers, got 7,000 people, and you know, no privacy anywhere. You sleep in a room that's got 80 other people in it, you know, and God, stink, and no privacy, and everything. So we went down to the kitchen, and we went into the refrigerator, big refrigerator, and we got this great hat. We had 2 grams of it, you know, that we brought in with us. Actually, I only took 1 gram in with me, and we and this guy were in there, and we got it locked up. You know, it's starting to get cold, and we're smoking this hash. We smoked the whole gram, and I go, fuck, we got burned. You know? He goes, well, I brought a gram with me. See, maybe mine's better, you know? And he puts that in the pipe, and we smoked that. I go, I got a little bit of buzz, you know? You know, fuck, you know, these guys tell us it's from Lebanon, you know? It's supposed to be the best hash there is in the world. So we were really pissed off, and we were calling the Lebanese every name in the book, and we were calling the Israelis every name in the book, and you know, it's probably because we bought it in Nazareth is why it isn't working. And we walked out of that refrigerator and we thawed out. Oh, but we were stumbling, falling, paranoia hit. We're out in the middle of the ocean, no place to go. And they have this recreation room where everybody stands around and they watch this little TV and they pipe movies in, you know, from somewhere else in the ship. And I kept thinking I was going to throw up and I was dizzy and I'm about to fucking pass out. And we'd sit down and that, you know, and you'd start to fall. And the paranoia set in, and there was a group of Filipino guys over in the corner and they kept laughing and pointing at us. And we started to like get real scared about that, and they know we're all fucked up and they're gonna steal our paycheck, and then we thought it was gonna be a Filipino uprising on the ship, and we got paranoid and took off back to the berthing areas, and like, you know, we really got paranoid of Filipino people on this boat. And if anybody's been in the Navy, about 80% of the people on the ship are Filipino. Every place we turned around, and it was like, you know, it was just feeding us. We're turning around, and there they are, fuck, they're following us, you know. It was complete insanity about that deal. It was. Okay, I lost track. I'm still trying to get into recovery here, see? That day, I wouldn't go in anywhere because I wasn't an alcoholic. There's no way I'm going to cop to being an alcoholic. You know? Well, we can't help you. We can't help you. Call everywhere. Finally, this one place up in Vallejo would take me, but they told me I had to kick before I came. So, and then I decided, too, I'm not going in until I watch the Super Bowl. Now, fuck you, I've lived through the whole season. I should at least get to see the Super Bowl. So I kicked for 3 days. I locked myself in a bedroom. And, I'll tell you what, I swear to God. Now turn tape over. I swore that I would never kick again. I mean, it's like, you know, I didn't know if I wasn't going to use again, but I knew I wasn't going to kick again. The first day wasn't too bad. The second day I was praying to die, and I was scared I was going to. And the whole time, you know, I couldn't even move. It was enough to like sit up in bed, maybe take a couple of drags off a cigarette, and I felt like I, which I probably hadn't bathed in about a month, and my hair was all oily and greasy, and my body just felt like it was oily and greasy, and nobody ever came in the room either. You know, my ex-wife came in one time and she asked me if I'd like to take a bath. You know, and I said, yeah, you know, just some warm water would really feel nice. You know, I was at the point where I couldn't stand to have anything touching my legs. The sheets hurt. I didn't have any strength to lift them off the sheets. And I started riding that bicycle where I was getting the spasms in my legs and everything. And so that she had to like carry me into the bathroom, and she had to stay in there in the bathroom with me, or I'd go underwater. I couldn't hold myself up in the bathtub, and the whole time begging for a bag. Just one bag, make this all go away, you know. And no way, you're not gonna do it. And I'm, you know, sniveling and everything else. And finally, after it was probably only 10 minutes. To me, it seemed like an hour. But the water was still warm, I think, so it couldn't have been that long. Finally, she just got pissed off, you know, and she says, you know what, fuck you. You want the bag, go get it. You get in the car, you're able to drive, I'll buy it. And I'm like, all right, you know, and I said, help me out of the tub. She goes, fuck you. So they helped me back into the bedroom, you know, and the next day I felt a little better. I was able to get up and walk into the living room, and I'd sit there for a little while, and I just, you know, I couldn't hang. I could get a little water and some orange juice or something, and then I'd have to go back, and it's like the Super Bowl's coming on, and I gotta see it. And I ran one last scam, and it wasn't really a scam. She just didn't want to hear it. She goes, yeah, go do your last bag before you go. Because I told her I owed this guy money, and you know, and I wanted to pay the connection off before I went. It's just, you know, give me one more. And I drove like 20 miles to go get this thing. I was living in Visalia and had to go over to Hanford to get it. And I did owe the guy for one bag, and I bought another one, and I did it, and I didn't get off. And I was so fucking pissed, and I thought he burned me, and I'm like, you know, you son of a bitch, don't you know what I'm going through? I'm going into recovery tomorrow. One last fucking bag, and you can't even give me one that's any good. You know? And he even made it a good size one, you know. It just wasn't doing it. I went back to watch the Super Bowl, and the Super Bowl happened to be the one between the Patriots and the Bears, 40-10. It was the most worthless fucking Super Bowl. I'd probably been 12-10, and I'd have still couldn't have enjoyed it. The next day, we packed me up. We started heading off up to Vallejo, and I fucking tried every trick in the book not to go, man. You know, but there was a part of me that wanted to go. There was a part of me that didn't want to live the way I'd been living anymore, but there was a part of me that was real fucking scared. You know, I don't want to go up here. I don't know what it's like. And they told my ex-wife on the phone, make sure he brings some pajamas and a bathrobe. So my thinking is this is going to be like one flew over the cuckoo's nest. I'm going to get to sit around. We're going to have little therapy sessions, smoke cigarettes, drink coffee, shoot a little basket, you know, and all that kind of stuff. We got up there, walked in, and the guy says, you know, you mind having a haircut? And I said, no, I guess. He says, well, that's a requirement to get in. You know, we only cut it about, you know, so it's about an inch long. I said, yeah, that's okay, you know. And he says, yeah, for like discipline, or, you know, if you don't follow the rules, you break the rules, you have to write an essay. You think you can handle that? I said, yeah, I mean, you know, I used to be a pretty good writer in high school. Yeah, I can do that. So they take me across the street to where the house is. And I get interviewed again, and this time they search me and check all my stuff. And no, I don't have anything on me. And they go through my wallet, and they find a razor blade and a straw. And it had been in there so long that when they pulled it out, the straw fell apart. I forgot I'd been, you know, I'd even been carrying it, because it's been like 2 years since I'd done crank by snorting, you know. And that's what it was there for. They took me in, and the guy says, okay, this guy here gets a haircut. They took me in this little bathroom. Sit me down in a chair, right directly across from the toilet. This guy gets some shears out. He goes, well, so you ought to get clean, huh? Yeah, I guess so, you know. He goes, well, you know, I've been here for 3 months. And I just love it. I think being clean is great. And I look down, and this guy's hand's going like this, you know, and he's filling up my head with this razor. I'm like, oh, my God, 3 months, you know, and he's fucking shaking and everything, and he starts skipping up along my head going, yeah. And about that time, this great big old guy, he comes walking in, stands right there in front of me, drops his drawers, and sits down on the toilet with a can of Glade. And I'm like, where the fuck am I at, man? This guy's running shit out to me about how he pimped his body for a bottle of wine, and he was eating out of garbage cans and fucking skipping my head. This guy here's going, you're going to really love recovery. And with two blades in my face. And I knew as soon as I walked out of this back room that there was going to be bars on the windows, and everybody had put the white coats on. So I knew it. Then I checked into the man who ran the place. The director had been clean for 15 years, and he got clean in cinema. And that's where he got his program. A month before I got there, they'd quit making people wear diapers and dresses and all of that shit. And, you know, like if you're going to act like a baby, you'll dress like a baby. You know? But I'll tell you what they didn't quit doing was enough to drive me crazy. You know, the little essays? You got 24 hours to write a 2,000-word essay on why you should pay your PG&E bill. And count it. Count out the words. 50 going this way, 50 going... When you got to the end, you know, you did it left to right, right to left. Count the words out in every 50... You marked it, 50, 100, 150, and they never read it. They fucking checked your counting. And if you counted wrong, they'd give it back to you and go, you figure out where the mistake's at. Now you've got 30 minutes, you know. It was attack therapy, man. It was You know, and what the deal was is like, you know, now that I'm out of there, I can see what it is they were doing, what they did, you know. When I was in there, I couldn't understand it. And I would go up to the counselors and go, "Why are you doing this? Why are you doing this?" And he'd go, "Fuck you, don't worry about why, do it." You know, and I could never catch on to that part. I always had to know why. Why are you making, and one day they had me out. And this is, you know, the way my thinking works is this is something that's really going to get me back into society. While I'm out raking the rocks around the house, it dawned on me why it was they were having me do some of this stuff. I mean, it just like came to me in a flash. I threw my rake down. I went running into the house to go tell this counselor why, and by the time I got there, I forgot. Oh, God, man, you know, get back in there. You know, get back out there. And what was really neat, too, is me and one other guy from Porterville. There was a guy from Porterville there, and we were the only two junkies in there. Everybody else, we had like two or three alcoholics, and the rest were all coconuts and cranksters. And me and this one guy, we'd like sit back and watch these guys, you know. And this one guy was fantastic, man. He'd come through the living quarters 10 times. He'd go through one door and out the other one, you know. I said, I'd give him about 10, 9. I said, "Poof, here he'd come," you know. And I said, "I bet he still ain't got that job done," you know. And all of a sudden, halfway through, he'd go, "Where was I going?" You know, you're going over that way, you know. Oh, man, here you go, you know. But that's how my thinking was, too, is I thought, look at all these weird motherfuckers, you know, and I'm just sitting here going, boy, I can see why they're here. You know, if my old lady would just slack off, I can get out of here. And like, this program was for a year. They tell you it's a year when you sign up, and then when you get in there and you've been there like about 20 days to God, nobody's made it in 12. You always fuck up, and it takes you 15. You know, and I'm like, huh. And they had this great little thing called the Synanon game, where you sat around in a circle, and they did it every Saturday night. What they did is you watched everybody else in the house, and if you seen somebody acting or doing something that was against the rules, you know, you'd go up to somebody else and go, "Hey, you see what this guy's doing over there?" "Yeah, yeah. I don't like the way this motherfucker's doing it." "Yeah, I don't either, you know. We'll get him Saturday." And so Saturday would come around, and they, you know, everybody had to say their names, and what that was called is you just made a contract. "I just put a contract out on this guy." You know? And they call on you. "Okay, Dave, you know you got a contract." "Yeah, I do. I've seen that certain person doing this and doing that and doing this, and the other guy's got a contract with me," and go, "Yeah, and I see this guy doing this and this and that too." And you'd watch, and about 10 people sitting there, and if you got the contract called on you, you had to get in the position. You had to put your feet flat on the ground, sit up, you got both arms in the chair, and that's all you could do. You had to sit there and take it. Well, we're still running a contract out. 10 people are sitting up going, and getting ready, you know. And they call it on the one guy, and everybody else would relax, and the counselors were over there taking names. That's when these guys had all set up, and as soon as you got done gaming this one guy, then the counselors would put everybody on the hot seat and set up straight while you were putting the contract out. They gamed me one night. The director gamed me my first night that they allowed me to play the game. You had to be there 14 days. This man read my book for 45 minutes. He had told me everything I had ever done, everything I was planning to do. I mean, he had me down. And I was crying like a baby. "Oh, God, yeah, you know, you're right." And the whole time, and then after it was over with, I was going, "Boy, that motherfucker told me how it was." And there was this girl sitting behind me. She wasn't allowed to play yet. She was a junkie, new one, had just come in. She goes, "He wasn't even talking to you. He was talking to me." Anyway, I got real upset there. These people don't know what Dave's all about. And really what happened to me is, like, I got to the point that I felt as bad in there as I did on the street. You know, and I stayed for 75 days. I stayed long enough so the hair grew out and I could put a little Vaseline on it and get rid of the porcupine. And everybody else who had wanted to leave, they took him to the bus station. When I wanted to go, they helped me pack. Incidentally, when I opened up my suitcase, my pajamas and my bathrobe were still in it. When I unpacked and got there, the guy goes, "What the fuck you bring this for? You're going to need this shit." I'm like, "Oh, God, man." I'm like, they opened the back door, not the front, and said, "Split. Let me walk." I'm like, "God damn, man. I'm in the Bay Area. I'm from the San Joaquin Valley, you know." And I didn't have a penny to my name. I went down to this liquor store, and I sat there next to it. I didn't know what the hell to do, you know, and I was right by the freeway, and I didn't, you know, and it's right there with 450 meets 480, that runs into 880, down to 460, that goes into, and I'm like, you know, I don't know which one I want to get on. I was lost. One of the counselors comes down and gives me a quarter, and he says, "Here, you know, I think if you call them back, they might take you if you say the right thing." I'm like, you know, I'm not going to suck ass to get back in that place. I'm going to suck ass so I can go back in there and fucking whip poor weeds and all this kind of stuff and get screamed and yelled at, you know. And my sister-in-law lived in Alameda. I called her. And this guy told me, too, really pissed me off. He told me right before he pulled off, he goes, "You know what? I can tell right now you're going to be a program junkie. You're going to get clean here, go out and get loaded there, check this place in here. You know, you're going to hit every fucking recovery home from the Mexican border to the Oregon border, and then you're going to move on there if you don't die first." And I got real pissed. And still to this day, man, I want to go back up there and go, "Yeah, let fuck you. I didn't go in any place else, and I'm clean." You know, and I know what they do is they go, "Fuck you, prove it." You got documentation or what, you know? Anyway, I went down to Porterville and got into a halfway house in Porterville. And it was there that I got tapped into Narcotics Anonymous. I walked into a meeting. First time they took me to a meeting, it was my second day there. We had to walk down to it. My folks and my ex-wife and everything wouldn't let me come back home. I had to go into another place. And I went into this place that was the complete opposite of where I left. They let you take naps. You know, and they go, "Go ahead, if you can take a nap, Dave." And I'd lay down on the bed, like flat, you know. And as soon as my eyes would start to close, they'd pop open, and I'd go, "Oh, fuck," you know, and I'd realize where I was at, and I'd go, "Oh, you know, I can't do that." But also what they did up there at that place in Vallejo is you weren't not allowed to isolate. If they caught you being off alone from anybody, you got in trouble for it. You know, which is like you stand out in front of the crowd and they all run out in front of you and rawr, and yell in your face and call your names and everything. And we had this one little tall, skinny, lanky 18-year-old kid. And one day I snuck into the bedroom and turned the lights off, you know, and I just got a chair back over in the corner and I just wanted to be alone for about 10 minutes. And I was just sitting there and actually I was like, looking at my life, like, man, you know, what the hell got me here? It still wasn't dawning on me that drugs had got me here. You know, and I'm sitting there, and I'm like, "Oh, my God," you know, and all of a sudden I hear this little shuffle of feet, and I'm going, "Oh, fuck, somebody's in here," you know, and I see this little guy, and "God damn it, don't come over here, don't come over here." And he comes around the edge of the bed, and he walks up to me, and he goes, "Are we isolating?" I flew off on him. He let it go, didn't say anything to me, and they gained me that Saturday on isolation. You know, the weirdest thing of it was whenever I got gamed, whenever they were yelling and screaming at me, it's all because they fucking hated me. They didn't like me, they hated my guts and everything. Whenever I had a contract on anybody else and we were yelling and screaming at this guy, it's because we were trying to help him. That's what I thought. When you guys were yelling at me, y'all hated me, you're picking on me and everything else, but if I'm doing it to you, I'm not to help you. You know, I got down to Porterville, got into NA, walked in, and there was like 60 people in this meeting. And I'm like, "My God." And I sat back in the back, and I sat there for a while, and all of a sudden, here it came. By the grace of God. Oh, shit. They put me in another one of these God things. You know, I tried Victory Outreach for 3 days. That didn't work. I left there, I found some guy in the closet in there screaming and stuff. They had me on the kicking bed, and all of a sudden I'm laying there, and I hear it in this closet, like that. I'm like, what the hell's going on? I open the closet, this guy's got his face in the pillow, screaming this stuff. I shut the closet back, and I was, you know, I laid back down. And I left after I got a couple hours sleep and another meal. So anyway, I turned around to this lady that brought me there, and I said, what the hell is this God stuff? What are they talking about? She goes, God, however you want it. I said, what? You can start a religion if you want to? She goes, that'll keep you clean. Oh, well, that's okay, you know. Kool-Aid for everybody. That's what I'm thinking. We'll get a cult going, and that's what I thought all this was all about. And you know what? And I knew as soon as I left the meeting, everybody started praying and did all that tongue shit and everything. Like I saw that guy in the closet, I knew that's what was happening. I'd leave, and all the people who'd been around for a while, I'm going, we'll sucker this fucker in for about 20, 60 days, you know, and you know, we'll lay hands on him and do all this shit. You know, but and then I couldn't understand. Is there the same person the next day? He comes over and visits the house. The same guy who's talking about God in the meeting is sitting there, and he comes over and he's telling me about how, hey, you see that babe over there at the meeting ward? I'd like to get a hold of that. Last night you're talking about God. Tonight you're talking about getting over on this chick. Now, like, supposedly if you get God, you're not supposed to be doing that, right? It's okay, I only got 30 days. and a meeting there in Porterville were brand new. They were brand new, they had just been started. And I'd heard a guy at a meeting not too long ago say, could you imagine going to a meeting and everybody there was newcomers? And I went, hell yeah, that's where I got started. We had to ship people in from Fresno to celebrate birthdays so we could see what somebody looked like that had a year. Everybody's running around with 90 days going, I'm going fucking nuts, I am too. Where's the connection? Right over here, let's go. And nobody was staying clean, and you know, we had like about three, imagine we had about 10 people that really hung it out, you know, that stayed clean from the get. Yeah, and at the beginning, that's what I used NA for, is, you know. I mean, one day I really thought I wanted to be clean. And the next day I used it when the new guy came in and he looked like he was still gouged out and everything. I went and sat next to him. You know, and like, where do you score at? Oh, here, you know. And, just in case, you know, I just want to make sure. I want to make sure it's still out there. And I'd go a few days and I'd go out and get loaded. You know, and I'd leave that halfway house. I'd go back, I'd get loaded, and I'd come back to the halfway house, grab my mattress and everything, go in the back of my truck. I got loaded, and he said, well, you know, in 2 weeks, if you want it back in, come back. And I'd come back in 2 weeks. I'd put everything in, and I'd stay another 2 weeks, and I'd go out and get loaded. And I'd come back, and I'd pack my mattress up, and I'd throw it in the thing. And they'd have a group on me while I was there, and they'd talk to me, and I'd go, you know, I know what it is, man. I'm just not working that third step. I can't work that third step. There's just something, there's a block there. I can't get that third step down. And that first one really scares me. I don't want to do that one, you know. I'm like, all this and that and the other thing. And the guy goes, fuck you, can't work the personal step. Well, yeah, that one too, you know. And that's true. What the thing was, and I'm able to look back on it now, the thing was is I couldn't work the first step because I didn't want to be a drug addict. To me, admitting to being a drug addict was like, you know, finally when everybody calls you a puss because you're not going to drink or you're not going to use. You know, I don't know how many times I got loaded over somebody going, what's the matter? I can't fucking handle it. And that's what it was to me in my head. All these people I had ever known in my life, if they found out I was going to NA meetings and cop to being a drug addict and I can't handle it, they're all sitting at home fucking laughing at me. And I can't do that. And to tell them that I'm supposed to be talking about God, you know, I couldn't do that, man. I could admit I was a drug addict, but I couldn't accept it. Somehow, some way, I want to be able to shoot dope on the weekends and go to work on the weekdays, and have no problems in between. And I hung around NA for 9 months, and every time I'd come back in, I got loaded again, and every time I'd say that, this one old guy would go, man, quit fucking around here. If you're going to quit, go back out here, go back out there. Get out there and do it right. Tie one on. Do it. Stay out there for 3 months, And I'm thinking, somebody could really get hurt. And it's not dawning on me, this guy's talking to me. I had no conception of that. On the 3rd of October, 1986, I took off on my last run. And on January 16th, 1987, I came back to the program. I came to the point, I was living in an attic up in a little house out in the country by the back gate of Lemoore Naval Air Station. One window knocked out, freezing cold, had to share my bed with the mice. I had a big cardboard cutout of Elvira up there, the dope wasn't working. I'd come down to the point where I was going. I found out where the high school kids were having drinking parties, instead of going to school during the day, and I was showing up there to play drinking games so I could get drunk real fast. I'd take my six-pack in there, drink theirs, and leave with my six-pack. And whenever they'd start to get a little drunk and they'd start to talk and shoot the shit instead of roll the dice and everything, I'd get real pissed. And I had them all buffaloed and everything, thinking, they think this guy's crazy, and they'd heard stories about me 10 years before. And the whole thing was, if one of them would have stood up to me, I probably would have crumbled. I was scared to death, and all I wanted to do was I just didn't want to feel. I hurt so bad inside, man, no matter how much I put in me, wouldn't make it go away. Finally, one day, I was able to hustle up a $20 bill, and I was on my way to go to the connection, and for some reason, it dawned on me that moment, what am I going to do tomorrow? Every time I got a 20, it's like, I'm not worried about tomorrow, I'm going to go do it now, and I'll worry about that later. And it's like the reality of it hit me that, what am I going to do? Fuck, man, tomorrow I'm going to go through all this shit. It took me like 8 hours to get a $20 bill. I've already had to put $2 in the gas tank. Now I got to go fucking beg to have them let me off this $2, And if I can beg a little bit more, maybe they'll let me have enough for a pack of cigarettes. And I was, bumming my friend's old lady. I'd wait till he'd go to work to hit her up for the money because she was an easier mark than he was. I'd already stole from them. And I called somebody up and I said, I think I'm ready to come back. I don't think I can handle this anymore. I was scared to go to sleep at night. And when the sun would come up in the morning, I was really scared. I didn't want to face another day. When the sun would come up, I'd cry. I can't do this anymore. And I'd finally, by 9 o'clock, I'd be so sick I couldn't stand it. And I'd get back out there and people were like, when I'd pull up in their driveway, the doors would shut. I could watch them close the door. And I could hear them inside. The garage doors open and I'd go inside the garage and knock on the door. They went to the kitchen and nobody'd answer. A couple of times I thought I heard them lock the door as I was walking into the garage. I still stayed out there for another week, man, just staying miserable as hell and going through this. And I packed everything up in my truck this day. And the guy says, before you go, help me load some firewood up. The house I lived in only had a wood-burning stove. So I went out to help him get some wood. And the first time I talked the guy into buying some beer before we went out there. And I drank a couple of beers with him. And already it was at the point, it used to be, once I got that taste of that beer, I knew I wasn't going to quit. And here I was on two, and I was really having to choke it down, and a guy had come over after we were unloading the firewood. The guy came over and put a big line of coke out, and I did that, and it lasted for about 5 seconds. And the guy says, here, you want another beer? And I said, no, I don't want no more. And I got the truck. I drove back to Visalia, And I walked in and I said, I can't do this. And, I give up. I went for a long time until that January 16th was the day. The first 2 days back, though, I drank codeine cough syrup so I could sleep the first two nights. So I changed my day to January 19th, 1987. And the weird thing about it was is in November of 85, my dad's mom died, and they had to load me up with Valiums and everything to get me to go to the funeral so I could be a pallbearer. And I carried guilt about that for a long time, I'd been clean for a year, and I went dragging up to the family, and I went to go tell my grandpa, who was still alive. I said, today I'm 1 year clean. He says, today's grandma's birthday. I went, fuck, I can't believe it. That's something special to me. And then I went over there and I went to her grave and I said, look, grandma, I did it. Recovery has been something fantastic. It has been real scary, and it has been a lot of fun, and it has been a lot of misery, all on my own making. The good times were my own making, and the bad times were my own making. I've gotten out of this program exactly everything I have put into it. Some of the rewards of the program for me, look. I came down here tonight to be a speaker, and look how many people from Visalia came. Today, I got friends, and I never had those before. These people were just as jazzed up about me coming down here as I was. This is the first time I've ever spoken to a group. And to have people come down and follow me down like this, and they want to be just the, because they like Dave, is really a hard thing for me to understand sometimes. Because I want to know why. What did I do? What do you want? And I had a hard time, the week after John asked me to come down and share, I kept running all this stuff out about what I was going to say. And it's real hard for me to come down here and just think all I got to do is be Dave. I wanted to be all these other people I'd ever heard speak, and Buddy tried to come over with a speaker tape, and I said, no, I don't want to hear nobody else's shit. To me, and they say that this program is attraction rather than promotion, and sometimes it's real hard for me to understand that. With my low self-esteem, it's hard for me to understand that people can just like me for being me, that I don't have to perform.